Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, what you may or may not know about the founding of America by Europeans. 1492 and Christopher Columbus, James Smith, 1607 and the founding of Jamestown, the Mayflower and Plymouth Rock, 1620. These may leap immediately to mind, but if you were to sit down and try to write a few paragraphs about the European discovery and settlement of America, many of us would find the assignment frustrating. How quickly would we turn to Google and Wiki? Something like this happened to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tony Horowitz, and it set him on course to research and write his new book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. Let me share with you a couple of the things that I learned from A Voyage Long and Strange. Did you know John Smith was a braggart, a con man, an escape artist, and an accomplished killer? That's how Horowitz describes him. He also says Smith was an exemplar of the American dream. Did you know English Massachusetts had first been settled because of syphilis? Horowitz says one Bartholomew Gosnold set sail for New England in 1602 looking for sassafras to be used as a cure. I had no idea. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Tony Horowitz is the author of Blue Latitudes, Confederates in the Attic, and Baghdad Without a Map. His new book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World, is published by Henry Holt. There's more about our guest and his new book at the website, www.voyagelongandstrange.com. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Tony Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me again.
My pleasure. Well, tell us how it was that you found yourself thinking about the early arrival of Europeans in the Americas.
Yeah, a few summers ago, I was on a road trip through New England and pulled off to see Plymouth Rock, where I'd never visited, this great icon of American history. The first thing that struck me is how physically unimpressive it is. It's basically just a cracked little boulder sitting in a dirty sand pit. But what really startled me was a conversation I had with a ranger there who said that visitors are very confused by the date etched on the rock, which says 1620, when the Mayflower landed. And they often ask, why doesn't it say 1492? Isn't that when Columbus arrived?
Ouch.
And as she explained it, a lot of visitors think Columbus sailed here, dropped off the pilgrims, and sailed home, that they know Columbus and the pilgrims, and everything else is kind of a blank. And at first this amused me, but then as I drove off, I started scanning my own brain for what I knew about the European founding and discovery of America beyond Columbus and the pilgrims, and I realized almost nothing. So that really set me off on this voyage to fill in that gaping hole in my knowledge.
Yeah, I know that on your website you have a quiz that we can take. I haven't had the courage to go there yet.
Right. Well, you'll be happy to know I did some of the research for this book during a fellowship at Harvard, and I gave a talk about my book in progress, and I gave a pop quiz to this room full of professors. And I'm sort of perversely gratified to report that they flunked. So I think it's fair to say even overeducated Americans are pretty clueless about this era.
Yeah. Well, you started your research by reading, and then you decided you'd do more. You'd look for history on the ground. So you decided that you'd hit the road. Where did your travels take you?
I really tried to follow this chronologically, and to tell the full story of the European discovery of America, you have to begin 1,000 years ago with the Vikings, who were the first known European visitors to North America. So I began my own voyage by going to the northern tip of Newfoundland, which is the site of the only confirmed Viking settlement that's been found in North America. It's a very bleak place. Even in summer, there are icebergs. It helped me understand a bit why the Vikings didn't stick around. I went from there down to the Caribbean to tell the story of Columbus, who, by the way, never reached what is now the U.S., then to Mexico and up into today's United States and really all across the country on the trail of these various explorers.
And what did this approach lend to your research?
A couple things. One, I think it deepens your understanding of past events to go to the places where history happened, to see what they look like, to see what the explorers were describing, to get a sense of the landscape and the climate. Also, at times, you can see archaeological remains, which I think, again, add to your understanding. But also, I like to... I'm interested in the present as well and how the past bleeds into the present. So going to these places helps me understand the legacy of these long-ago events and how they're remembered today.
Yeah, it's also interesting to learn what people living in these places today think and feel about the history of that place.
Yeah, and there definitely tend to be regional differences, as you might guess. I've recently moved from Virginia to Massachusetts, and in Virginia, people are very aware and proud of Jamestown being the first permanent English settlement on this continent. In Massachusetts, they really disregard everything before Plymouth, even though Plymouth was quite late in the story of European settlement. And then, for instance, in the Southwest, people are obviously more aware of the Spanish history there that precedes the English. And I don't know, in Illinois, or at least maybe in northern Illinois, there might be some consciousness of the role of the French, who were, significant in the Great Lakes area and also in northern New England.
Yeah, they were also significant in the, I want to say the southwestern part of Illinois,
mm-hmm.
Along the Mississippi.
Right. Well, I restricted myself ended my book really in 1620 because I didn't want this to be a multi-volume work. So I didn't get into that, which I think is a slightly later period.
Yeah. Well, fairly early in the book, we can come back maybe to the Vikings because it is interesting that we think of them as being very hardy and big, tough guys.
Right.
And they couldn't take it.
Right. Well, it wasn't so much that they couldn't take it. They were indeed very hardy folk, and the places they came from were just as forbidding as northern Newfoundland. What they couldn't do was do what they had done in Europe, which was subdue their foes. They were, we think of them as mighty warriors, but they were no match for the Native Americans they encountered, who were well-armed with bows and arrows and catapults. They outnumbered the Vikings. They attacked them in fleets of canoes, and basically the Vikings, who came in very small numbers, realized, they couldn't stay. So, and they left. And then really in the first recorded contest between Europeans and natives, the home team won.
Yeah. How do we know about the Vikings in Greenland, in Labrador, in Newfoundland?
Right. Well, it's interesting because our primary source are the sagas, the great Icelandic sagas that were originally stories told 1,000 years ago. They were later written down by medieval clerics and have sort of filtered down to us that way. They were long viewed as very unreliable as historical sources because they tell these quite fantastic and supernatural stories. But it was actually a Norwegian man, Helge Ingstad, in 1960, using clues in the sagas, as well as some other clues, who actually discovered this site in northern Newfoundland. So there's a strong kernel of truth to what's in the sagas, even though they are a thousand years old and do mix, you know, fact and fiction. In addition to that, you know, there's been archaeological work not only in Newfoundland, but in Greenland, which was the colony from which they came, and Iceland, so that they can match what they found in these various places and understand about the material life of the Vikings and other aspects.
The Norse sagas, if they mix fact and fiction, would you say that, in a sense, or really, that's what we do with our history as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, everything changes in the telling, and clearly with the sagas over the centuries, you know, stories became embroidered or mixed up. I think, you know, our history isn't that ancient. I think instead what we've done is created a series of myths and then clung to them, really, despite a lot of evidence to the contrary. So this sort of myth of pilgrims, you know, settling a virgin wilderness, this sort of untouched land, and really beginning the American story, you know, is with us forever, probably, and it's a wonderful story. It's just that there are a lot of other stories that should also be included.
Yeah. Well, tell us the story or the non-story of John Smith and Pocahontas.
Yeah, I mean, what interested me about doing this book was not only were there dozens of expeditions and characters and Spanish, French, Portuguese, etc., that I knew nothing about, though even the ones that we think we know about, we really don't. Most of what we know is myth and misconception, and John Smith and Pocahontas are probably exhibit A for that. If Americans know anything about them, it's that they had a love affair. Well, I'm sorry to report there's no evidence of that. Pocahontas was only about 10 when John Smith met her, and he was gone not long thereafter. He wasn't in Virginia all that long. And she goes on to marry a different John, John Rolfe, who's really unfairly forgotten because he's also a very significant figure in the early history of Virginia. I should add that Pocahontas dies of disease on a visit to England at about the age of 19 or 20. So really her story overall is more tragic than romantic. It really doesn't match the Disney version, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and why should we remember John Rolfe?
For one, his marriage to Pocahontas was something that hadn't happened before, an English person marrying an Indian and also the daughter of the powerful Chief Powhatan. So it brought about a period of peace in Virginia that allowed the colony to grow. But more importantly, he was the first to really successfully grow tobacco in a colony in North America. He brought some seeds and experimented with different strains of tobacco. And within a few years, this became a fantastic cash crop, and it really saved Jamestown from ruin. It had done very poorly up to that point, but tobacco became a craze.
Okay, well, now tobacco gets us to Columbus.
Yeah, well, again, Columbus is one of these figures that, you know, perhaps makes us yawn. We learned a little bit about him in school. He's not only nothing like the storybook version, he's much more interesting. He's really, I guess I was taught, you know, that he was this sort of farsighted modern, this visionary who knew the world was round when everyone else thought it was flat. Well, for starters, that wasn't an unusual opinion. Most people thought the world was round then. And in fact, he later recanted of that view and decided the world was shaped more like a pear, with the stem he likened to a woman's nipple, and imagined the Garden of Eden at the top of it. So he really was more of a medieval mystic who was sort of chasing a globe of his own imagining, and really up to his death still thought he had found the Indies, despite four voyages to America that showed this couldn't possibly be so.
Yeah, and you say he commands more print than almost any man in history, yet he remains elusive. He, you say, invited this mystery. How and why?
He was a very elusive fellow. He came from a very modest family in Italy, and he was a man of his day. This was a feudal time where status and titles meant everything. So he concealed his modest origins. He really masked himself in all kinds of ways. He signed his name in a way that's yet to be conclusively deciphered. Again, he was this quite mystical character. We don't know where exactly in America he landed on Columbus Day in 1492, somewhere in the Bahamas. We don't know to this day exactly where his bones are. And part of my book is a sort of goose chase to the Dominican Republic to see his alleged bones unveiled. So despite everything that's been written about Columbus, there are many important things we don't know about him.
Yeah. Is his description of tobacco the first we have?
The first by a European, yes. He arrives in the Bahamas and sails on to Cuba and the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And he sees now natives are offering Columbus and his men this sort of strange weed that they obviously value very highly. And then he realizes when he sees them smoking it, what it's for. It seems that the word tobacco, which was a native word, actually referred to not to the weed itself, but to these kind of giant cigars that they smoked it in. And so that's really the first record we have of tobacco. And many other crops and creatures that were really unknown in Europe until Columbus's voyage and after, potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, all these things that became staples of diets around the world were really unknown until Europeans discovered the New World.
Mm. What else can one glean from his writings?
You can kind of see the sad story that's going to unfold. Another thing that he starts writing about almost from the moment he arrives, he writes quite sympathetically of the natives. He thinks they're beautiful and very nice and hospitable, but he immediately says, and they'll make great servants, and he suggests bringing them back really as slaves to Europe. And that begins the whole sad saga of slavery in the New World, because what happens is the Indians don't really work out as a source of slave labor. They die very quickly from European diseases. They run off and can kind of, melt away because they know the landscape and can run off to other native settlements. So before long, the Spanish begin importing African slaves to the Caribbean mm-hmm. and other colonies. And so that story really begins with Columbus as well.
Yeah. Now, Columbus has been celebrated. He is also today much vilified. What's your opinion?
I guess I come down a little bit in between. The pendulum has really swung from one extreme to the other. He was long viewed as this heroic navigator who brought Christianity and civilization to the New World. And then obviously in more recent times, he's seen as, sort of the advanced man of empire, the beginning of the whole sad history of European treatment of native people. Much of what he did certainly resulted in, death, disease, despoilation, dispossession. It's not a pretty story. On the other hand, when you set him alongside many of those who followed, I don't think he was an instinctively barbaric character. Many of the later explorers, particularly the conquistadors, really started killing almost from the moment they landed on the beach. There's actually not one recorded death during Columbus's first voyage. I think at heart he was a nonviolent man. That didn't prevent the damage that followed,
yeah.
But I think it's wrong to see him as a monster.
Yeah. Well, one of the people who came after him, Hernando de Soto,
mm-hmm.
Now he is a grim character.
He really is a monster, and to me, in some ways, one of the most fascinating characters in this book. I don't think we have to admire these characters to recognize that they did astonishing things. De Soto was really kind of a Spanish Ahab. He took an army, landed it in Florida, and marched across 3,000 miles searching for elusive treasure that he really never found. But he refuses to give up, and he continues this death march for years until it kills him, half his men, and untold numbers of Indians. He was really more damaging to the South of that era than Katrina and Sherman's March combined.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine is journalist Tony Horwitz. His latest book is A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Well, when did the Spanish begin to move beyond Hispaniola?
Yeah, contrary again to what I think many Americans imagine, Columbus never came here to what's now the U.S. And the real locus of the Spanish Empire in the New World at first was in the Caribbean and then Mexico. But in 1513, a man named Juan Ponce de Leon sails north from Puerto Rico, and if he's remembered it at all, it's for the Fountain of Youth. There's no evidence he was searching for one. He was only 39 at the time. But what he did find was a lush shore he called La Florida, better known to us today as Florida. And in the 30 years that follow, the Spanish really march across the continent in a number of expeditions, covering roughly half of today's continental U.S.
Yeah, that was interesting to realize as well that by 1542, the Spanish had an empire in this hemisphere larger than the Roman Empire.
Yeah, this was one of the great explosions of empire in all history in an incredibly short time. The Spanish not only reached much of this continent, but obviously Central and South America and crossed the Pacific to the Philippines. They really had this unbelievable global reach and also tremendous wealth for a period from the gold and silver that they looted from the New World as well as other products.
Yeah. How did they rule it? Were they good administrators?
Well, it depends how you look at it. They were certainly very efficient. They were great bureaucrats, the Spanish. And it's really an asset for people like myself studying this era because they were great record keepers. They wrote down everything in great detail. So we have muster rolls on the armies and endless court documents. They were also very legalistic. They were constantly suing each other. So we have really a wealth of material. I should add, they were even great record keepers about their atrocities. So we have, again, very very good records of some of the horrors they inflicted on natives. They were also trying to convert. This wasn't just a mission of conquest and greed. They really were infused with a missionary fervor to bring Christianity to the New World. So they also sent large numbers of missionaries here, many of whom died, to try and convert the Indians with, I would say, rather mixed success.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Tony Horwitz. Let's take some calls now. We've got a listener waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm afraid I haven't been able to listen fully to the program because I got distracted. But one of the things that I hadn't realized growing up and I've now learned is that there were lots of Native Americans around where Plymouth Colony was established. But a number had been wiped out by illnesses brought by traders who hadn't made permanent settlements but who had passed on these illnesses. And so there were a lot of cleared areas that show up in the names of towns like Greenfield, Clearfield, things like that, that go back to the time when the Europeans found settlements and fields already, the fields were ready for them because they'd been cleared and made use of by Native Americans. And even the the pilgrims, when they arrived in the fall, they didn't have any food. And one of the things they did was they robbed caches of food, hidden supplies of food that Native Americans had stashed away for them for their own use.
Mm-hmm.
All these things tend to give a different view that a lot of us don't realize. And one of my favorite cartoons that a friend sent last fall shows a wall being built, a palisade being built by Native Americans, and behind it you can see Plymouth Rock, and there's the pilgrims arriving in a boat, and the caption is, "They say they're building a wall because too many of us enter illegally and won't learn their language or assimilate into their culture."
Well, you're exactly right on both points. First on Plymouth, as you said, and to me this is why this early history is important. It's not just a series of colorful, obscure stories. It really helps explain what happened later. And the pilgrims were by no means the first European visitors to New England. And those who came before, as you said, brought disease, so that that really cleared the whole coast of Massachusetts, was devastating. So that when the pilgrims came to Plymouth, they effectively settled a ghost village. In fact, that's why they chose it. They came, there was fresh water, there were cleared fields. And they built their homes really on top of this abandoned settlement that had been wiped out by disease. And also as a result of that, they had no one to oppose them in the way that often happened earlier in America. And this was true really across the continent to greater or lesser degrees. A disease, may have caused what some scholars believe was the greatest decline in population in human history during this era of early contact, anywhere from perhaps 75% to 90% of the population succumbed to these diseases to which they had no immunity. So this is a very significant part of the story. As to your second comment, I wrote this book against the background noise of the immigration debate. And I have to say, I was often struck by the contrast between what I was hearing on the radio about the threat to our culture from new immigrants and the history I was following, which told of the Spanish and the French and the Portuguese and others who were here long before the English. We're not really an Anglo nation now, but, we weren't at the start. This is another one of the many myths about our early history.
Mm. Enjoyed your program. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener in Humboldt, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Line 4?
That's you, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. I want to read this book, but I recently read another book you wrote called Confederates in the Attic, and I thought it was wonderful, and it certainly seemed smart as far as on the myths that we have been led to believe and what truth really is. So I can't wait to read this book.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. And I'll say you'll find a little overlap with Confederates in that, one, a lot of this book takes place in the South as well, but also because I indulge in a bit of reenacting. Not
Confederates this time, I noticed that in that other book. I wondered how you survived it. But
I thought that was the worst thing I would ever do for the sake of a good story, but I can tell you that being a conquistador is even worse. Wearing 60 pounds of plate armor and chainmail in 90-degree heat in Florida, as the Spaniards did, and trying to clunk around in this sort of tin man outfit is even more wretched than wearing a smelly wool in Virginia.
Well, I hope you don't go worse than that, then.
I think I might hang up my helmet for a while.
That might be a good idea. I like what you write, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Also, that sweat lodge in in Atlantic Canada. Whoa.
Yeah, for some reason I do a lot of sweating in this book between playing a conquistador, my time in the Dominican Republic where I was just kind of a pool of sweat the whole time I was there, and then even in Newfoundland, which is quite cool, but I tracked down the descendants, really, of the natives who chased the Vikings off 1,000 years ago, the Mi'kmaq tribe, and they were having a powwow, and they invited me to join them in their sweat lodge. I'd never done this before and imagined a sort of locker room sauna, and found instead it was really a four-hour ordeal that was like being cooked alive. So that's another experience I'm glad to have had and hope never to repeat.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for this interview. I want to throw out a couple of more names and have your comment on an attitude. The two names are John Cabot or Cabot and Henry Hudson. And what's with the European hatred of the forest that they found in North America? It seems to crop up under different authors that write about this period.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Cabot, I discuss a little bit in the book. We don't really know much about him, but in 1496, just 4 years after Columbus, he's actually believed to have been of Italian descent, but he's sailing for England, gets a license to sail off to explore this strange new world, and goes and appears to land in Newfoundland, but he doesn't really explore very much. He just kind of goes around the edge of the coast, comes back, and the King Henry VII is very happy and sends him off again, and he never returns. As someone contemporary wrote, he's thought to have discovered no new lands except at the bottom of the sea. And that was actually quite typical of English voyages for the first sort of 100 years of this period. They were not only latecomers, but they were quite incompetent. Almost all the early English voyages end in disaster. It's not until Elizabethan times that they start having some success. Henry Hudson, also not a great deal known for sure, but he, of course, sails around Canada and then up the Hudson River as far as Albany, and he's sailing for the Dutch. So, again, that's another European part of the picture. As to the forests, I haven't come across many references to really hatred of forest in the accounts that I read, but they don't view the landscape the way we do today. They are quite afraid of it. They're there fighting for survival. They're not looking out at mountains and forests and huge rivers and thinking, oh, what wonderful natural beauty. They're thinking either, oh, I see, 50 acres of cordwood or some valuable resource, or they're thinking, oh, my God, you know, we have to march through that. So they certainly are kind of overwhelmed by the American landscape.
And also want to thank you for Confederates in the Attic also.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye.
I should add, you know, in terms of natural landscape, one of the most striking places to them, interestingly, is the Great Plains. Coronado and his men ride for about 1,000 miles across the plains, and they describe it as a sea of grass. They've just never seen someplace so flat and treeless, and it really astonishes them.
That's because they didn't fly over it, right?
Exactly. I mean, we some Americans tend to sort of, you know, regard it as flyover country, but to them it was perhaps the most striking landscape they came across in the Americas.
Well, for us, it's home.
Right.
Yeah. Tony Horwitz is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author, most recently, of A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Back to the Mi'kmaq people of Canada, of that area of Canada. How do they view this history? How do they tell the story of the arrival of Europeans?
Right. Well, the arrival of the Vikings is so long ago that no one really, I mean, there are some legends that had been passed down. But the Europeans then return to eastern Canada in the late 15th and early 16th century. And there are certainly memories of that. They thought the ships approaching were floating islands. They thought the masts were trees. One of the Mi'kmaq elders described to me a story where they thought they had some kind of strange seaweed on their face because the Mi'kmaq didn't have beards, and, you know, who were these pale, hairy people? You know, there are many of these kind of wonderful impressions of first contact, and unfortunately we generally only get them through European eyes, what the Indians were thinking. But obviously they remember these events less fondly than the non-native population, because what followed tended to be quite devastating for Native peoples. The tribe that was really occupying Newfoundland at the time, the Beothuk, were actually driven into extinction in the early 1800s. So the Mi'kmaq moved in the 18th and 19th century, and are among the tribes that have endured, but that's not always the case.
Yeah. Also, what you just said shows us once again that as human beings, we're always moving around.
Absolutely. It's, you know, I think we also make the mistake of thinking that somehow Indian culture was static, you know, before the arrival of Europeans, that, you know, nothing had changed in, you know, hundreds or thousands of years, and they were sort of just waiting for Europeans to arrive. In fact, when you read particularly the Spanish accounts of the South and the Mississippi Valley, you learn about this fantastic mound culture, as it's known, and I assume there are probably mound cities or the remains of them in your area. It was a very settled, sophisticated, populous society. You know, America wasn't filled with, you know, roaming bands of nomads. There were ancient and very developed societies. And for instance, one near St. Louis, known as Cahokia, is believed to have had 20,000 people in the Middle Ages. That may not sound huge to us, but that's larger than any settlement in North America until Philadelphia surpassed it in the late 18th century. So these were significant cultures, and sadly, the Spanish were really the first, but also the last, to see mound cities when they were still really a living, breathing culture.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering, we certainly know that there was a great population reduction, but I believe some of the students of the subject now think there may have been as many as 200 million Indians resident in North America in 1490.
Uh-huh. I haven't heard numbers that high. You might be thinking of all the Americas. I mean, the estimates are all over the place because obviously no one took a census, and there's no way we can know for sure. I think the higher estimates that I've read are 70 to 100 million for the Americas as a whole, which would have made the Americas more populous or more populous than Europe at that time. In North America, there may have been as many as 20 million people, which again is a huge number when you realize that England, for instance, had about 2 million at that time. So again, you had a very large and significant population. And I think Americans tend to think of the Aztec in Mexico and the Inca in Peru, and don't realize that really almost comparable societies existed here in North America.
Well, 20 million seems low because there were about 20 million Indians killed in Mexico alone.
Well, again, you know, the numbers are very sketchy, but I guess it's also whether you include Mexico and North America. That's a bit of a geographic question. I'm not in the numbers I was giving. I'm not including it. I would have Mexico separate from that. But sure, if you include Mexico, then yes, it was probably much higher than that. And Mexico is where we have some of the best documentation of the devastating impact of disease. We even have early artwork of Indians suffering from smallpox. The Aztecs themselves did drawings of this. So we know that it was truly devastating. But it wasn't the same story every place. There's still a lot we don't know about the transmission and impact of disease.
I think there's also been an assertion that what is the disease, the rodent-borne disease of the Southwest.
Oh, right. Hantavirus?
Mm-hmm.
Or?
Yes.
Right.
That might have become epidemic at that time. The book I'm thinking of is 1491, I believe,
yep,
is the title.
Yeah, it's 1491 by Charles Mann. And if you're particularly interested in this subject, that's the best book you can read. It's a very balanced and accessible read. It's basically a summary of current scholarship across the Americas. It's not just about North America. It's probably even more about Mexico and South America, looking at, you know, what did America look like before Europeans arrived? What was the population, the landscape, and then, you know, what happened? So I think that's an excellent book, and I refer to it in my own, so there's no better place to start.
At any rate, the death in that period puts the Black Death in Europe to very minor.
Well, I'm not up on the exact numbers of the Black Death. I think it was pretty awful, too.
It was about 50% of the population,
yeah,
to 75% in places,
yeah,
so that would have been less.
Probably less. Again, it's a very difficult area to research because the Europeans who were writing about it at the time, of course, didn't understand germs. They didn't really know what was going on. We don't have proper numbers, and in many cases, we don't really even know what the diseases were. And some of these diseases may have had different forms then. So it's really very hard. We're working with pretty sketchy material, mm-hmm, in a lot of instances.
Well, very interesting,
mm-hmm,
topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Tony Horwitz, our guest this afternoon, author of A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. One of the things that I wondered about as a kid in history class was Roanoke.
Mm-hmm.
Roanoke Island. What happened to those poor folks?
Were
you able to come up with anything new?
Well, hard to say. Roanoke is one of those wonderful mysteries of American history. These 114 colonists, including Virginia Dare, are left there in 1587 and simply never seen or heard from again, other than all kinds of rumors. And, you know, people have studied this to death, and I spent a long time there sort of following some of the people who are still trying to solve this mystery. And I don't want to give it all away, but the best,
yeah,
I can say is there are several different theories. Generally, either that they melded in peacefully with Indians, or that they died from starvation because there was a drought at that time. Or that they were killed, that they moved up to the Chesapeake and were killed by the Virginia chief Powhatan, who feared they would aid the settlers who later came to Jamestown. Until they find archaeological evidence, you know, someday we may find a grave or a settlement or some evidence of what became of them. But I think until that time, it will remain a mystery.
Yeah. Why do some stories fade while others are burnished? Why does some history get lost?
Right. Well, I think partly it's because, you know, some of these stories don't make for a terribly uplifting national narrative. The woman who called before and mentioned how, you know, the Pilgrims essentially settled on top of Indian bones. Well, when this nation was new in the late 18th and early 19th century, and people started thinking about, well, what are our roots? What's our history? It makes sense that, first of all, since most of this history was written by New Englanders in that period, that they exalted the role of their own forebearers and you know, disregarded or neglected the contribution of Catholics, because after all, they were Protestants, of non-English, even of Southerners. I mean, after all, Jamestown precedes Plymouth by 13 years, but it still plays second fiddle somehow, and that's largely a legacy of a sort of northern bias against the South that deepened with the Civil War. So, you know, there are a number of factors, but even Jamestown, you have a really quite horrific story where starving colonists are eating each other. One man even kills and eats his pregnant wife. Well, those aren't the kind of stories that naturally make their way into sort of national myths of origin.
Yeah, and also that'd be a tough sell in the classroom.
Well, actually, I think it'd be a great since
well,
I'm a
yeah.
son, I think it'd be a great sell in the classroom. They'd love gore.
Yeah, well, maybe at a certain point, but I can't imagine an 8-year-old coming home and saying, "Guess what I learned today in school?"
Right, and in terms of patriotism, it's a little hard to generate the same pride in your nation's history when you emphasize some of the darker aspects.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here pretty quickly, okay. But before we go, I mentioned Bartholomew Grosnold in my introduction, and maybe you just tell us just a little bit about him. He's really an interesting character.
Yeah, he's the first he and his men are the first English that we know of to reach what's now New England, and Grosnold is a great namer. He sails around this cape where his men catch a lot of fish, so he calls it Cape Cod. He lands at a beautiful island with grapes, and he names it Martha's Vineyard, which happens to be where I live, and then sails on to a small island that's now Cuttyhunk, where he and his men find sassafras, which you mentioned in the opener, was thought to be a cure for syphilis, and they dig up a ton of it, and they had planned to settle there or have a trading post, but they get a little anxious and they sail home. Gosnold later dies in Jamestown, so his story is quite brief, but I think it's kind of interesting that the first English in New England weren't there seeking religious freedom, but to get rich from a cure for syphilis.
Yeah. There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Tony Horowitz, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Tony Horowitz is the author most recently of A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. The book is published by Henry Holt. There's more about our guest and his new book at the website www.voyagelongandstrange.com.